Hello everyone, thank you for listening to Gut Feeling. This is Yusra Khan. My conversation today is with one of my favorite educators. Have you ever met someone who absolutely loves to explain things and happens to be really good at it? Well, that's Professor Cassini Nazir for you. He's a clinical professor at the University of Texas at Dallas. He is an ATEC professor, but he's very famous in the Brain and Behavior School at UTD. His passion is teaching design. If you're a UX designer or a UX researcher in the DFW area, I highly recommend sneaking into one of his classes while he's teaching. You'll walk away with brilliant ideas exploding out of your mind. Here is my conversation with him. So I'm thinking about in terms of how you got involved in design and how did you make that decision to teach design? Like, you could have easily gone and worked as a UX designer. You're very passionate about the subject. But what made you want to choose to teach design? There's a difference between teaching and working as a designer, for sure.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think I've always been a teacher at heart. When I was a kid, I could always draw really well. So I would do portraits for friends, for families. I found it to be a great way to meet people of the opposite sex. I was naturally shy, but it sort of gave me a vehicle for that. And so I always consider myself when I was younger that I was going to be an artist, and designer just wasn't even in my vocabulary.
I see.
So I didn't even, you know, and I'm talking as a teenager, even all the way up to sort of early, very early college, design was never sort of a thought that I had that this is what I'm doing. I really conceived it more of creating art. However, when I was a freshman, a good friend of mine who graduated from the business school over at Southern Methodist University with a business degree created a startup, and he hired me as a designer, not an artist. And so I worked on logos, I worked on type treatments. I remember I designed a logo that appeared on a billboard in Dallas, and driving down the highway in Dallas, I remember, you know, my 18, 19-year-old brain just seeing that and looking up and being so proud that was my logo, right? Everybody has that moment. And I sort of got an inkling of what it meant to be a designer. But at the beginning, it was never design.
Yeah.
For me, it was arts, and it was very old school art. In fact, I did a lot of hand drawings of figures and portraits, both in pencil and then colored pencils.
Yeah.
And I really detested at the time computers. I didn't want to do anything with computers. And you know, it's so funny that, looking at my career, most of what I do is with computers. The design work that I do, at least for interfaces. I think I've grown to realize that you can be, I think you're a designer of conversations. I think I help designing conversations help in the interactions that we have sort of face to face. But I think for a long time I've been a designer of interfaces, right? Of what are the buttons that we press, but all along the way, I see teaching as the design of conversations and the design of meaningful interactions with information all along the way.
Now, I have to ask you, how do you differentiate between art and design? Because obviously you had that journey, right?
Yeah.
So,
you know, that's a tough question. And there are a lot of people who'll disagree with what that means, the difference between arts and design. And there's so much overlap that it's hard to have a very crisp line on the contours of the two. But I think for me, arts is very much expressive. Designers need to express themselves, but artists have much more freedom to be able to do so in a way that designers don't always. Meaning that many designers work in a commercial space. They work for companies and they have to work within the confines of the companies. Most artists don't have that problem. I know that's very much a generalization. But designers have to think about people who aren't them. Artists do as well, but designers have a lot of processes that they undertake in order to try to put themselves into the mind of the other person. when I first started out designing, I wasn't doing that kind of design. I wasn't designing for somebody else.
Yeah.
I was designing for myself.
I see.
You know, that's an unsatisfactory, I'm not satisfied with that answer. I think it's much more complicated than that. But I think the methods that we undertake in design versus the arts lead us to different, very different spaces.
Yeah.
Arts, the thing, maybe I should put it this way, my interpretation of arts and my experience with the arts has been very introspective. I've used it as a lens to understand myself, the world around me, how people think, history, right? The arts, I think I've told you that I started a classics degree at UT Austin, for which I left.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think I would have done that had it not been for my exploration of the arts, right? The arts was this open space through which I was transported to many different worlds, right? Of literature, history, et cetera. Design, you know, we don't approach it that way.
Yeah.
The Nasher, I think it's still at the Nasher, has this prehistoric... prehistoric pieces, and I believe it's arrow points. And these were designed objects, right? These were things that people used to kill animals, to sharpen knives, to cut their hair, right? Day-to-day activities,
mm-hmm.
not art, right? And I think, in a sense, why I say that the line between art and design is so blurry is that there are things that we walk into an art museum that were really objects that were designed. Nobody, when those objects were first created, nobody ever said, we're gonna hang this up on our wall and leave it there and it's gonna be an object of beauty.
Mm-hmm.
It was purely an object of function. Only with the passage of time has it come to be that these objects are more, we view them in our 21st century mindset as objects of art rather than designed objects. But you know, it's, That's where I think that fuzziness occurs of objects once used, Wedgwood, porcelain, at one point in time was used, right? I mean,
right.
It wasn't just meant to be hung on your walls.
So it's kind of like there's a process in time where a good design today will become art.
Yeah.
You know, eventually.
Yeah.
Because it might not be useful for them, where design is something that we... You know, it's complex. So maybe spoons
mm-hmm.
will one day be art, and they might not be a good design anymore. You know, objects today that are good designs or that are our daily basis, like a cup of coffee, you know, holding that cup of coffee will eventually become art. We might not have to hold that cup of coffee anymore.
Yeah, and you know, the Heller mugs that Massimo Vignelli designed, I want to say back in the 70s, if I'm not mistaken, are to me as much art as they are design. Like they're beautiful. Massimo Vignelli says Americans don't know how to drink coffee because I think the original designs Americans would spill coffee on themselves because of the little lip that was there. But to me, that's I like the arts infused approach to design because design today can be very much, especially digital arts, let me take an interface that somebody else may have designed, a kit. Let me invoke those widgets, those buttons, those colors, and in a sense, the thinking of the visual components is less necessary. That's freeing because you can think more about functionality.
Mm-hmm.
But everything looks like everything now, and that's a very boring world to live in.
It's true. Do you... with your classes that you're teaching, obviously you have students that are from ATEC, and then you have students that are like me coming from BBS, and then maybe you've had some other types of students.
Computer science.
Okay.
So you're a cognitive science, the arts and technology students. I've had arts and performance students as well.
Mm-hmm. A diverse group of students. And then I think about how do you prepare yourself to teach people coming from all these different fields and teach them the same exact language of design, you know? And in your class, last semester, I mean, I found your class to be very challenging, but I was never frustrated, which is, you know, a big deal.
Frustration can be good, though.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
But, and then I remember that you had us do, like, 100 sketches of, like, the smallest thing. And in my head, first, I mean, I had only known you for, like, what, 3 or 4 weeks. And I was like, why am I doing this? You know? And then I, as I'm doing the sketches, I'm improving, improving, improving. I had never in my life realized that that was even possible, that I would have to do something 100 times in order to come up with, like, a, you know, like, my finalized product. And I think I ended up doing more than 100 at one point, because when I got to 100, I didn't even realize I was at 100. I went past it because I was like, okay, I can do this a little bit, you know? So we're in this time period where majority of us are always on screens. And in order to do design, it requires us to pick up a piece of paper and a pencil and put that screen to the side and focus on that. I never got to tell you this, but that became like a meditation activity for me, because I felt like I was connecting to the pencil, the paper, and my thoughts, and just repeating over and over and over and over and improving slowly, you know? But I'm sure that's not always easy for you to expect that from other students, that they do this activity 100 times.
Yeah, well, I think what one of the things that was interesting in what you said is that you improved, right? And what do you think you improved on in that activity?
Well, for me, I improved on just kind of drawing. And I mean, I guess the first thing that I noticed that my hand was getting a little bit more comfortable, mm-hmm. and the shapes were looking more like, I think I was trying to draw a dove, more like a bird versus like, you know, just something random that's just outside. Or maybe in the beginning I was paying attention to certain details, but then later on I realized that if I only have like 10 seconds, maybe I need to focus on the bigger picture to make sure this picture looks more legible. Mm-hmm. So I was able to realize what I was not able to realize initially when I started. Sounds funny. But yeah, that's, you know, like your realization and your perspective changes, but it changes gradually. It's not like all of a sudden like the page flips, but it's like slowly you start seeing some things that you notice, you know, in that time period.
Yeah, I think your description of that as a reflection tool is really interesting, right? The sketching isn't just, doing 100 sketches isn't really to produce 100 sketches. It's to improve your thinking about whatever the thing is that you're trying to address, whether it's a problem, whether it's even helping you to understand, right? The 100 sketches helps you to pose problems rather than just pose solutions, mm-hmm. and think about it. So it's not even, it's not necessarily the number. However, that number gives you a large enough, it gives you a large enough amount of time to be able to say, okay, I can screw up with some of these. But you, once you hit the 10 to 25 range, that's when you've sort of mm-hmm. plucked all of the low-hanging fruit, and you've got to climb a little bit higher up. And at some point, you realize that, you know, to extend this metaphor a little bit more, that there's this sunlight, right? At some point, you see the sunlight, and your perspective on it changes.
Yeah.
So rather than looking up at the tree, you're now looking down on the forest, if mm-hmm. you will. And that's a very different perspective of looking at the object, the tree, versus understanding the object in the context of where the object sits, the forest. And that's a hard thing to teach to students. But I think really what it takes is a willingness on the student's part. I think teaching is the wrong word too.
Yeah.
And I don't know that, because I think embedded there is the concept of there's one person who teaches the many that are in the class. And that's not, mm-hmm. that's never the right model. Who you learn with matters just as much as what you learn. And I don't mean that the who in that sentence is the instructor. I mean the students in your class matter just as much. And the engagements that are possible there. There have been classes that I've attended where I've learned more outside of the classroom, just in the hallway going into class, than I have inside that space. But I think a good teacher designs the classroom in a way where the likelihood of you engaging with others around you is increased. And again, thinking of it as the design of conversations, how can I structure the class in a way that it makes these conversations more likely and students can sort of hone their skills with each other? That's hard with some of the younger students because they don't talk as much in the graduate classes. I find students talk more. In the undergraduate classes, I'm finding that they talk less, but your class was much more talkative. I think because you were in there partially.
Yeah, I think this semester in the class on informational architecture, what you said about, you know, to the students about not worrying about or thinking that you all have an A already and you're all going to get an A in this class. I think...
So let me just be clear, though. What I said was, think about the student who asked the question failing.
Yeah.
Who is worried about failing. Mm-hmm. My response to him is, what would you do if you were going to get an A?
Exactly, yeah.
If I didn't promise an A.
Yeah, you absolutely didn't promise an A. But that sentence, that line itself is like, you're putting fear to the side. And one of the reasons why people or students are not participating in discussions is because they don't want to be wrong, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. And you basically said, remove that hat and put on a different hat. Like, you are already going to ace the class. So how would you think? How would you do things differently? Mm-hmm. And that's a big deal, you know? And that I think that changed, even after that conversation, that changed the environment of the class. People started participating more, mm-hmm. You know, and it means a lot. And I think that this is something that you did a great job in designing the class and the environment in the class. And I think other faculty and other professors should be doing that from day one. It's like, how do you make it comfortable for other people so they can participate, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. And we've had conversations about this where, you know, I tend to speak a lot more than other people do. I like to talk a lot, and I'm usually the first one to take initiatives. Mm-hmm. But I've learned from my journey as being management and leadership that the most effective leaders are the ones that speak last or maybe wait till it's the right time instead of speaking first. Because when I speak first, I don't have the opportunity to learn from other people. And sometimes when I speak first, I influence other people's what they're going to say.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't want to do that. I want to learn from other people. I don't want them to take what I'm saying and be like, yeah, that makes sense too. You know, and then them putting their opinion to the side.
Yeah.
Because I know one of the problems and one of the strengths that I have that I happen to be really great at influencing people. And that could be and I don't want that part of me like come out as a nice sales pitch. Mm-hmm. And then the other person's like, maybe I should not say what I have to say, mm-hmm. because this sounds better. Mm-hmm. And that right there, that could become the biggest problem for people like me. So, but you create an environment where everybody wants to speak. You know, people are like, I'm going to speak because I'm confident and everybody's speaking and I want to be part of that, you know?
And that's a challenge. I have noticed that change when you began the design principles class last semester. And, you know, I think just given given your background, you were walking into a space where you were using skills that you had picked up in the past that have been useful to you.
Mm-hmm.
And I really pushed you, the skill being persuasion.
Persuasion.
But, you know, design's not always about persuasion.
Mm-hmm.
It's in order to really feel confident in the design, that the design outcome, you have to do a great deal of exploration. And persuasion, I think you learn too early, can lead to not enough exploration, right? You don't, you know, if it's trying to cover a map, you cover a square rather than the map, right? And I think one of the things that I've seen from you is a big growth in that area of exploration, right? I think that's really to be commended. There's a story, I can't remember the book that it's from, but the story is of a kid who comes home whose mom picks him up from school, and the mom asks, you know, what did you learn today to make conversation? And the kid says, nothing. And, you know, the mom's not happy by this, but the mom responds just something like, you know, what do you mean you didn't learn anything? what am I sending you to this school for? And the kid explains, well, my teacher said, you learn by making mistakes, and I didn't make any today. That's always stuck in my mind, that what are we really teaching if we're promoting the students who always get things right? And when I first started teaching, I would call on the students who were who knew the answers. And that may not be the right model of teaching, is going for the students who have the right answers, is the, you know, don't make any mistakes model. that's not how you can teach design.
Yeah. That's good. Well, thank you so much. I think we've covered all the ground. Yeah. Thank you so much for speaking with me. I hope to record one more podcast with you.
Sure. Be happy to. This was fun.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Yusra.